Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
This week on September 30th, Canada will be recognizing the impacts felt from Indian residential schools with the National Day of Truth and Reconciliation. And joining me on today's show to talk about the day and some of its history and the Mohawk Institute in Brantford and a little bit about his history with that as well is Cody Groh, Assistant Professor in the Department of History and the Indigenous Studies Program at the University of Western Ontario. So thank you very much for doing this today, Cody.
Thank you for having me.
So can you detail some of the work that you do at Western within the History Department and Indigenous Studies Program?
Sure. I've been at Western for just about 3.5 years now, and I teach courses relating to Indigenous history in what is now Canada, Indigenous history predating Canada. I also teach courses on museums and public history as they relate to Indigenous peoples, so how First Nations, Inuit, and Métis communities are reclaiming our ancestral and cultural sites, are reclaiming our cultural artifacts. Then again, I also teach courses on residential schools, which is particularly important for both First Nations, Inuit, Métis, and non-Indigenous students as well.
And what inspired you to take on that path and led you to teaching at a university level on those topics?
I think, it's definitely been a breakaway from the rest of my family's trajectory. My father did not finish high school. He passed away in 2022, and he dropped out of school at about grade 10. He was a survivor of the 60s scoop who was returned to his biological parents when he was about 10 years old. And my grandparents were survivors of the Indian residential school system as well, notably the Mohawk Institute. So it's definitely a big transition away from the experiences of some of my family members and some of my ancestors. But teaching in the university context has been so fulfilling to see, especially First Nations students from local communities who are coming, who are taking Indigenous studies, who are challenging what they've learned before. And it's also so important for me to learn from the students on a daily basis. And I really do think of it as a teaching experience for both students and me as a professor. So it's been great just to try to engage in those conversations.
And so speaking on your work and how it relates to the National Day of Truth and Reconciliation, how does the commemoration of Indigenous landmarks and historic sites work towards that?
I think one thing that's interesting about both the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation and about commemorating historic sites is that question of, is this surface level recognition? So for example, when the Canadian state recognizes a site as being a national historic site or nationally significant, does that actually come with anything, or is it just sort of a surface level of acknowledgement? And, you know, a lot of my research looking at how Canada has commemorated sites in the past, you really do see the Canadian state sort of massaging the interpretation of what they would like to present as being nationally significant or relevant to the story of Canada developing. And that's often ignored or minimalized or erased Indigenous histories. But as well, when we look at the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation, when I teach that to my Canadian history students, my Indigenous history students, my residential school history students, we always ask, is this a day that is meaningful, or is this a day that's a surface level acknowledgement? And I think I really do think it's both. I think that it's so vital. I know that for the first day ever that the National Day for TRC was celebrated, my father, who was just diagnosed with cancer at that time, it was so meaningful for him to see all of the orange shirts. And he went to the Mohawk Institute site where his parents attended, and he was very visibly moved. But then we also see a lot of acknowledgement from businesses, corporations, political figures who really do treat it as just a surface level day, a passing recognition. So, you know, National Day for TRC commemoration, they go hand in hand, those conversations about, is this something that's meaningful and who is the appropriate audience?
And speaking on how the day has evolved, I guess, what kind of sites would you like to see recognized that maybe don't get recognized by Canada during this time?
You know, I really do think of that question, and I will give a shout out to Heather George, who's the current executive director of the Woodland Cultural Center, who has been a friend of mine for many years. And we've had conversations about this in regards to some sites associated with Six Nations or with other Haudenosaunee communities. And one thing that, you know, she really challenged me to think about is how perhaps commemoration from the Canadian state is actually counter to ideas of Indigenous cultural or political sovereignty. And that's really an idea that I'm embracing more and more. Like, recognition by the Canadian state as something being nationally significant is perhaps something that's important for the Canadian state and the general Canadian population. But we can also recognize that federal recognition of significant sites might not be in line with intellectual or cultural sovereignty of Haudenosaunee citizens, of First Nations citizens across the country. So I think that really is a question to balance about, you know, moving forward, do we want to see more sites commemorated or recognized by the Canadian state, or do we want to challenge that idea of what commemoration means in that context?
And recently it was announced that Woodland Cultural Center is seeking to have the Mohawk Institute designated as a National Historic Site. Could you speak on that and what it would mean to have that designation be successful?
Sure. So the designation of National Historic Sites of Canada had been around since 1919. There's something called the Historic Sites and Monuments Board of Canada. It's an advisory board of historians, archaeologists, museum curators, one representative from every province and territory. And they consider proposals for recognizing either sites, people, or events as being nationally significant. And all of those recommendations for national significance are then approved by the federal government through the Minister of the Environment. And when we look at the Mohawk Institute as potential National Historic Site, we've seen recently a wave of other former residential schools being designated as National Historic Sites. But one thing that's really interesting is the justifications for why these sites are significant is often challenging perhaps the colonial interpretation of residential schools. So it's recognizing the assimilative aspects of the residential school. It's recognizing the systemic harm to families and communities. But it's also looking at a site like Woodland and saying the significance of this building is not just the residential school system, but the fact that since 1972, it's been a site of language revitalization and cultural continuity. So I think that's what's really interesting about a potential national historic designation for the Mohawk Institute, the ability not just to focus on cultural assimilation, but then also the ways that the Haudenosaunee and other First Nations have reclaimed the Mohawk Institute and the Woodland Cultural Center to revitalize our culture and ensure cultural continuity. So I think it's really exciting to see this conversation happening, and I think that the team at the Woodland Cultural Center will really truly engage in consultation and collaboration with community to assure that the right interpretations are presented.
And do you know what kind of role that the community, the Indigenous community, would play in shaping the public's memory, I guess, yeah, about the community's past with the site?
I think that's really open to the nominator. In this case, the nominator would likely be the Woodland Cultural Center. And I think that community involvement will be based on the approach that Woodland would find beneficial in regards to this process. At the end of the day, what's really tricky about a National Historic Designation is that the final decisions are made by the Historic Sites and Monuments Board of Canada, this federally appointed advisory body. That being said, in regards especially to residential school commemoration, they almost will always accept the recommendations that are made by descendant communities, so by Six Nations or by Watar, by whatever communities have a role in the Mohawk Institute as well. So I think what we'll see is we'll see a community involvement. I'm sure we'll have interpretive sessions or ask for advice from the community. It'll be dependent upon what the nominator Woodland finds is best for them, from my understanding.
And just talking about your personal history with the building and discovering that your grandparents attended it in the 1900s, can you walk us through that experience and what that was like finding that out?
Sure. So my grandfather, Stanley Grote, attended the Mohawk Institute in the 1910s. He was born in 1910 himself. He attended the Mohawk Institute for only a few years, and then he was amongst the children impacted by enfranchisement following the First World War. So he left the Mohawk Institute in 1919 upon his father and mother being enfranchised. And then he later engaged in the process of getting his status back. My grandmother, Jean Maracle, her story is a bit more complex and convoluted. She was born during the war as well, and she was not raised with her biological parents. She was raised with uncles and cousins. And from the best of our knowledge, she was potentially at Indian day schools in Six Nations for a small period of time before attending either the Mohawk Institute or Mount Elgin. And she was she was not comfortable disclosing any of her experiences. So we're sort of working through that archival paper trail with the National Center for Truth and Reconciliation. So like many of our ancestors and family members, there was the reluctance to engage in storytelling. And both of those figures, my grandfather Stanley and my grandmother Jean, died in the 1980s before residential school discourse was really part of our public conversations. And before there was that more transparent openness to share experiences as students.
And did you or your family members ever feel any impact from finding out that, like, realization?
So my father was a survivor of a 60 scoop, and he was a really unique situation. He was removed from his biological parents, Stanley and Jean, who were residential school survivors. But then he was returned to them later on. And he had a very fractured relationship with his biological parents. And he referred to his parents as broken people. And that was really hard for him to really embody that family relationship. But when he was in his late 60s and early 70s, my father, that's when the dialogue of residential schools started to become more transparent and more open and part of our day-to-day experiences. And my father really learned about his parents' experiences through this general dialogue, National Day for Truth and Reconciliation, the work of the TRC. And my father kind of ended his life by still thinking of his parents as being broken people in his language, but he understood what they had experienced and what they had gone through and what shaped their lives. And it gave him a sense of closure to know that history and to understand that's what shaped the trajectory of his parents and their lived experiences. So again, I think that's what's so vital about days like the National Day for TRC. They can be really surface level and really performative by some politicians or businesses or corporations, but they also do have the impact of encouraging residential school dialogue and creating a better understanding for both survivors and descendant communities, as well as the general public.
And so I guess on a personal level, how would seeing the Mohawk Institute commemorated feel, knowing your grandparents' history there at the school and the kind of impact that can have on your family and other families in similar situations?
To me, I think the number one thing that I would want to see through this designation, and I think the thing that would mean the most to me, is not just designating the Mohawk Institute for the cultural assimilation and for the abuse it took there. I think it's important for us to tell those stories, but I think what would be the most powerful is if the commemoration really centers on the work of survivors and Six Nations and other descendant communities to reclaim that site and to assert that our languages, our cultures, our beliefs are important and that those themselves are nationally significant as well. And I think if that were to happen, then it would be a really milestone event for Six Nations, for Brantford, for the entire national dialogue of commemoration.
And just lastly, before we get you out of here, how can Canadians meaningfully engage with the messages of truth and reconciliation beyond just recognizing September 30th and working towards that goal throughout every day of the year?
I think, again, recognizing that structural changes still haven't occurred. We still have Indigenous nations who are fighting actively to have our traditional forms of government recognized as being legitimate, keeping children within our nations and within our communities. And one of the things that I always tell my students most transparently is we can recognize the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation, but also still recognize how fundamentally, from a human rights level, there's so many nations and communities that don't even have clean drinking water. So when we look at this conversation about atrocities that happened in the past, we can also really center the fact that atrocities are happening in the present as well. And I think keeping that in mind is so vital when acknowledging the National Day for TRC.
All right, Cody, thank you very much for doing this, and thank you for sharing your story with us as well.
Yes.
Roughly 100 Montrealers gathered on Wednesday night to honor Indigenous victims of police violence. Six Indigenous men and women were killed by RCMP and local police over an 11-day period between August 29th and September 8th. A seventh man, 42-year-old John Wells, was killed on Tuesday.
So we did this because we want to honor Haas Lightning Saddleback, who was 15 years old. I have a 15-year-old. And Jason West, who was 57. And Tammy Bateman, who was 39. And Danny Knife, who was 31. And Jack Pichet, who was 31. And Iggy, who was 31.
Naguset is the director of the Native Women's Shelter. She co-organized Wednesday's vigil with Day Shelter Resilience Montreal.
I don't understand why this continues. I don't understand why it seems like it's open season on Indigenous people, and it's just fine to kill us, and no one's going to complain, and no one's going to make a fuss about it. Like, why aren't there rallies across Canada saying that this shouldn't happen?
There's a long history of colonial violence against Indigenous people, and it's kind of enough is enough. In the last, in 11 days, we lost six Indigenous brothers and sisters in Canada due to violence from the colonial guards, we call them, the RCMP, and some of the municipal police. It's a really sad, sad day. We're here to honor those families and honor the fallen ones.
Bryce Morrison began the vigil with a Sundance song to honor those who have been lost and to give strength to the grieving families.
I ask Creator and our source of all life, our Grandmother Moon, to watch over us and to protect us and to show us all the good things.
Well, I really hope the song gives the people strength, as it does come from the Sundance. It's powerful, and it's also a prayer. Our songs are prayers, and we sing them loud and hard in order to help heal people.
Naguset invited speakers from the Black community as well.
And I reached out to the Black community because in my experience doing the work that I do, I've always looked to the Black community for their leadership when it comes to discrimination and racism.
One of those who answered the call was Spence Telemac. Telemac does community outreach with the Union United Church, a Little Burgundy institution that was the first Black church in Quebec. He says there are parallels in the way Black and Indigenous people are treated by police.
When it comes to the systemic racism that is very rampant here in Canada, if you look at Montreal, for instance, we deal with so much racial profiling issues from the Black community. When it comes to people that are Indigenous, they deal with the same type of racial profiling. We deal with things in a very different way, but at the same time, we're both suffering. And I feel like when you look at Canada, unfortunately, some of the people that suffer the most are from people from Indigenous communities. And it doesn't make sense. If this is their land, we need to honor them more, give them more quality service and the support that they need.
These systemic racism is not written in black and white. It's hidden underneath policies, attitudes, beliefs, and the way that people get treated.
It's a message that was echoed by Ellen Gabriel, a prominent Mohawk activist best known for her role in the Oka crisis. She says the issue goes beyond policing.
The Royal Canadian Mounted Police said we've spent enough money on Indigenous people on policing. This is not a frickin' issue about policing. I'm sorry. This is about taking the lives of five innocent people who had mental health problems or were just guilty of being Indigenous. This is about getting justice for them and their families. This is about putting the police in their place. You do not touch me. You do not touch my family. You do not touch my land. You do not come on our lands and protect the corporate interests who are stealing our lands.
We now invite the public or anyone that would like to offer their tobacco and their intentions for these families to the fire.
As the sun set, an ever-growing line, at least 50 people in total, came up to put tobacco in a ceremonial fire, offering prayers to the dead and the families left behind. Resilience Montreal Director David Chapman says that kind of community support is crucial.
It's critical that people do show up at events like this because attendance at vigils indicates to governments whether an issue is on the public's radar, whether it is it something that concerns them at all. And if no one shows up, it sends the wrong message.
I'm Jules Bijal, reporting with the Local Journalism Initiative. Thanks for listening.
This is Bird Note. When a northern saw-whet owl spreads its wings, many birds can see something our human eyes can't. The owl's flight feathers glow. It's invisible to humans without the help of an ultraviolet black light, which reveals a bright magenta color. Producing this otherworldly light is a trait called photoluminescence. While some bird feathers simply reflect UV light, photoluminescence involves special pigments or structures in the feathers that absorb UV and then release light of their own, often in a different color. Some cases of luminous feathers have an apparent purpose. For example, parakeets called butterygars have glowing feathers on their crowns and cheeks that may help them stand out to mates. Over 50 species of parrots, as well as some toucans, have similar gleaming ornaments. But for other birds, such as owls, we still don't have a good idea for the reason behind the glow. The luminous owl wings do have a specific use for biologists, though. Scientists realized that they could estimate an owl's age based on the pattern of luminescent color on the wings, which changes predictably as birds grow and replace their feathers. It's a practical application of a beautiful mystery. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel.
Wandering Rhythms, Mondays from noon to two.
Join us in a weekly sample of music from planet Earth.
The strangest mixtape you will ever hear.
Desert blues.
Balkan punk.
Latin funk.
African psych.
Pigeon rap.
And anything and everything else you can imagine, equally represented by all continents.
Because good music is universal.
Wandering Rhythms.
Mondays at noon on CJSF 90.1 FM.
November 1885, eight Cree men were hung at Fort Battleford. They were found guilty of murder in relation to the Frog Lake Massacre. They were tried in English, although they did not speak English. The children were brought in from the Battleford Industrial School to watch and to learn that the red man is now living in a white man's world.
They took the ropes and hung them high. And eight men lost their lives. Bodies dumped in on my grave, where the late forgotten not forgave. They hung them high up in the street, for every one of us to see. They made our children in fear, as we wiped away their tears. Said these Indians, they gotta learn that they're living in a white man's world. Only English spoken court, and Johnny. what they heard they did not know. But still it led them to the gallows pole. They hung them high up in the street for every one of us to see. Made our children watch in fear as we wiped away their tears. They said these Indians, they gotta learn that they're living in a white man's world. The sky was lit, blanket of stars, northern lights in the sky, shining hard. The ancestors watched, tears from angels, the children cried, those days were fatal. Wondering spirit can be broke, the strongest ropes. What was yours, they got different DNA. The secret to the strength is Creator's way. Creator's way. No more hangings in the street. It's not something we need to see. Still there's trials and there's tears. Indians, they seem to fear that we're living in a white man's world. Yes, we're living in a white man's world. Still living in a white man's world. Yes, we're living in a white man's world. I'm living.
Soca's first and second year social is happening soon. Join SFU Soca, the students of Caribbean and African ancestry, in the Student Union Building, room 1430, on Friday, October 4th, from 5 p.m. onwards. This event is for the first and second years to meet and connect with new friends. All are welcome. See you there.
You're listening to CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
It's time for Gardening with Embark. Joining me in the studio here is Pablo Vimas from Embark Sustainability here at Simon Fraser University. Welcome to the show again.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So we're officially into the fall.
Correct.
We had the
yes.
sort of equinox last week, and now we're officially into the fall. But the fall weather's been with us for a little bit.
Yes, so we had a good weather before the weekend, and it was quite warm, and we thought like, oh, summer still is here, but nature is very wise to remind us, no, we have changed to the fall, and this week we had quite a lot of rainfall.
And the rain and the weather can create problems in the garden, and something you need to be paying attention to.
That's right. So with this heavy rain that we had lately, most of our trellises, which could have been holding or supporting beans or tomatoes, they might be on the ground because plants still are full of leaves, and the leaves with this amount of rain, they get very heavy. And the stronger the, if your trellis is not too strong, everything will just collapse because of the weight.
Right.
So at this time of the year, nature reminds us, well, it's time to start looking after your garden, cleaning up, becoming a good janitor, cutting all the plants that are spent. So tomato plants, by this time, most of our tomato plants here in Burnaby, we have a blight. So it's no point to keep them anymore.
Right.
So remove the plants and the beans we've been harvesting, and as well it's time to remove and make space for other crops.
So I remember when we talked in the spring, you also talked about the importance of gardeners also being a good janitor in their garden. So what does that mean?
So in the spring, we were talking about preventing the slugs, providing a nice environment for slugs to hide in there,
yeah,
and they eating our crops. Now is being a good janitor is keeping, I mean, removing all your trellises,
mm-hmm,
and putting them away. Any structure that is standing, remove it and lay.